The third case for oral argument this morning is the case of Wilcox versus Vermullen. Vermullen is the appellant, Wilcox the appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Dennis Finch, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, we have Mr. James Olson, an attorney also from Rapid City. Justice Konenkamp has disqualified himself in this case, and the court has appointed, once again, the Honorable Richard Sabers, a retired justice of this court, to sit in Justice Konenkamp's place. I remind you once again, if you wish to, as you leave, please feel free to help yourselves to the publications that we have available in the lobby. With that, Mr. Finch, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
It pleases the court, counsel. I'm Dennis Finch from Rapid City. As you said, I represent the Vermullen estate in this matter. We have a story here of two ladies who were good friends whose husbands died together in a tragic airplane crash. They proceeded to a wrongful death case together as co-plaintiffs with common counsel. However, when the cases were finished, all by settlement, they couldn't agree on the allocation of the proceeds and presented that to the trial court, which in our estimation is a totally different type of case. Now they're adversaries. They were co-plaintiffs. Bart Banks represented both of them at the wrongful death action, came to Mr. Olson and me and said, I cannot represent them in this allocation because it's a conflict of interest. And therefore, Mr. Finch, would you represent Ms. Vermullen, and Mr. Olson, would you represent Ms. Sheasley? So that's how we got here. Neither of us were involved in the underlying action, but we both were obviously involved in this case. And therein lies what I believe to be a central problem with the case, and that is that once you get to the allocation process where there's been no judicial determination or no jury verdict as such telling us which plaintiff gets which damages, then judicial estoppel simply doesn't apply.
Does any kind of reliance apply?
I'm sorry?
The other side, I'm sure, is going to tell us that they relied on that initial settlement of the case. That's why they joined in the settlement. What do we do about that?
That is the essence of their argument, Your Honor, and the problem is that though judicial estoppel simply doesn't apply because there was no prior judicial determination in that wrongful death case. There was simply a settlement out of court. We don't know what the jury could have allocated X amount of damages to Ms. Sheasley and X amount of damages to Ms. Vermullen, but we don't know that because the jury never got there. And so without a prior judicial determination, judicial estoppel can't apply in this situation because, and moreover, in my estimation, we have an inherent conflict. We now have two people that are adversaries, and in order for the allocation process to work, it's an adversarial proceeding. Both sides have to be able to present their cases as fully as they can. And in our opinion, my client was denied that right by the application of judicial estoppel. There's obvious reasons why plaintiffs joined together and why these two ladies joined together in the underlying action, but we would submit that if the court allows judicial estoppel to be maintained here, that it could have a chilling effect on potential for joint representation of multiple estates for fear of having your ally later turn on you.
Wouldn't it have a chilling effect if we agree with you on future settlements?
I don't know that it would have that, but certainly if you are going to go into a wrongful death case with multiple defendants, there would be less inclination to have the same counsel and the same experts, but by the same token, it would be unlikely that even if you had different experts, you would probably not want to cross-examine your co-plaintiff's expert during the underlying action. But again, this allocation process is different because the jury in the wrongful death case is looking at damages in a different sense. Now we've got the damages established, albeit by settlement here rather than by a jury verdict or by a judge's determination. We now have to figure out, the trial court has to figure out how to divide that up fairly and equitably. That's the standard in the statute.
It would make it'd make no sense, would it, to require the two parties to challenge their own expert or their own lawyer that where there's no allocation being done to present testimony and evidence to impeach their own witness or to challenge their own lawyer who's presenting their case?
Well, that's precisely right, and I think we all know that when this case proceeds, counsel makes the determination on the expert that the parties really didn't have a lot to say about that. To not allow the Vermeulen estate to present competing evidence in the allocation trial, in effect, defeats the essence of an adversarial action.
Were the parties represented by their own counsel at the time they selected counsel to try the case?
There were three plaintiffs in this case to begin with, and my client and Mr. Olson's client had common counsel.
Right, but did they have their own attorney to select the common counsel?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Were they represented by counsel before they selected Mr. Banks to present their case?
Not that I'm aware of. Mr. Banks has a long history of being counsel to the Action Mechanical Company, which was the company that owned the aircraft and the two people that were, well, there were three people killed in the crash, but my client's husband and Mr. Olson's client's husband were co-employees of this company, and Mr. Banks had a long-standing relationship with both of them, so I think that's how he ended up being counsel, but I don't know that for a fact. The Teledyne case, which I cited at page 4 of my reply brief, it's a federal case, but I think what it says is that in these kinds of actions or in an adversarial action, truth seeking is the main focus, and you cannot get there if judicial estoppel is applied. But just the bare elements of judicial estoppel that this court has ruled on in the past are not met here. There's no prior judicial determination, as I said, because these cases were settled. So there's no risk of an inconsistent decision by the trial court in the allocation versus what happened in the prior case. We've got different issues. As I pointed out earlier, we're seeking here an allocation of damages. It's a different test. There's two separate statutes. One statute that defines damages for purposes of a wrongful death case that a jury can consider, and the other statute which charges the trial court with the responsibility of allocating those damages fairly and equitably.
Under your theory, then, say that you wanted to resolve this issue in the underlying action, the stipulation of the parties would be the only way it could be done?
In the Warren case, I think I understand your question, but in the Warren case, which was cited by Appley and also, I believe, relied on heavily by the court, this court said that parties that entered into a stipulation could not later come back and take an inconsistent position. And it was a stipulated settlement, but there was a judgment entered based on that stipulation. So we did have that prior judicial determination that's necessary to meet the criteria for judicial estoppel.
Counsel, does it make any difference that all these proceeds were paid into a trust? And is the court really looking at the wrongful death allocation statutes, or should they be looking at the trust statutes on distribution out of a trust where there's no provision for distribution?
That's a very interesting question, Your Honor, and this action was actually started. The pleadings tell you that it's a declaratory judgment action to disperse the funds of the trust. But those funds were put there as damages that were received by virtue of settlements in the various cases here. So we have kind of a hybrid situation, and I think Even though it's a declaratory judgment action to disperse the funds of the trust, I think the parties were in agreement that the statute for allocation of wrongful death proceeds should be followed by the court. And again, because this was a settlement, and I think that's critical because no one knows or will ever know what, how that number was arrived at. Now, certainly Frankenfeld, Mr. Frankenfeld's testimony was taken at the trial court level, and both parties agreed to use him as a common expert. But even if the, you know, again, even if the two estates had separate counsel, they still may join in one expert. That's commonly done as well. But the bottom line here is that my client is not arguing that the total damages settlement should be different, but only how it should be allocated. And without the ability to do that in an adversarial setting, which in my estimation simply goes out the window with the application of judicial estoppel. If this case can't be a true adversarial action, then why is it even necessary to have the apportionment statute? That question was raised in the Corder case, which I cited in my brief, and I understand it's an unreported decision, but nevertheless, the facts there are quite similar to our situation. And again, they talk about this adversarial action process, which is clearly what happens when people who, beneficiaries who are entitled to wrongful death proceeds can't agree. And we obviously couldn't agree in this situation. Now, the trust question, Your Honor, also gets into the second issue, which I've raised, and that is the allocation itself. Well, there is actually a side issue there that I raised, but the allocation process, one of our, I guess, assignments of error, if you will, is that the trial court, again, by adopting Mr. Frankenfeld pretty much in total, he had testified in the underlying action that the actual earnings at the time of his death by Mr. Sheasley were $63,000 a year. Because his father was the CEO of the company and he was the heir apparent to the company, and the assumption was that he was going to be the CEO at some point, and his father was earning a salary of $100,000 a year, Frankenfeld presented two scenarios, basically one using the $63,000, the other one using the $100,000, because he felt that was more of a, I guess we'll call it a better test of his earning capacity because he would get there someday. But in our view, that's pure speculation, number one. But number two, I think the law is fairly clear that actual earnings at the time of the death are the measure, and his earnings there were the lesser, the $63,000. But the trial court chose to adopt the $100,000 figure in making her determination on the allocation. So in my view, that was not proper. Now, the other thing is that Frankenfeld extrapolated out that higher figure, but he also, in one of his reports to Mr. Banks, although he didn't testify to that, but he suggested that Mr. Vermeulen's total economic damages were larger if you used the highest earnings on his tax returns rather than what he was earning at the time of his death. And they chose to use what he was earning at the time of his death, and the trial court stuck with that. So in essence, we used the highest possible value for the Sheasley earnings and the lowest possible for the Vermeulen.
Well, one other question on the motion for a new expert. Was that as to economic damages, which were testified to originally, or Mr. Frankenfeld, or are these, did you want an expert on non-economic damages? Isn't that the essence of where you were trying to go?
Yeah, my motion was twofold. One, we had some real questions about what I just talked about with the differentiation in earnings, but Frankenfeld testified very clearly and unequivocally that he did not consider non-economic damages, which obviously the trial court has to consider in allocation. Now, a jury might have done that had the trial been completed. A jury might very well have assigned, we would have known what the total damages were to each of the plaintiffs, and they would have considered both economic and non-economic damages. The other point that I raised is that Frankenfeld did not give any consideration to Ryan Vermeulen, my client's son, who was living at home at the time of his father's death and dependent upon him, gave no consideration to economic loss separately for him. And moreover, Ryan and Carla Vermeulen, the daughter, never testified in the underlying trial because it settled before they got there. So my motion was not only to the extent of wanting to have a different analysis of earnings and lost earnings, but also non-economic damages.
Was that in the motion? Was that in the motion that you were seeking?
Yes. Actually, what happened is that I had notified counsel that I intended to hire a separate expert, and he brought on a motion in limine. We discussed it with the court, and the court advised me to make a motion to ask leave of court to present expert testimony. And there's a separate transcript on that should be part of the record. That motion hearing was conducted before the trial. And it's kind of interesting to read that transcript because it almost sounds like the court is going my way and then at the last minute simply says, we're going to deny your motion on the basis of judicial estoppel. And I don't know, I don't want to use up too much of the time on that, but the court states in the transcript, you'll see in the transcript, for example, at page 7, well, I understand that, but he's not going to bear the burden of apportioning equitably the claim. So I'm going to consider Bart Banks' comments. There was a letter by Mr. Banks that was part of the record. In this letter, as controlling on that issue, I'm concerned about the fact that Frankenfeld didn't address that. There's no evidence. That's the court statement in that hearing on my motion, and yet it was denied on the basis of judicial estoppel. Now, perhaps it could have been denied for other reasons, but there weren't any really other reasons discussed, and Mr. Olson's objection was based on his theory that judicial estoppel applies. And I can't stress enough that I don't see how it could apply because there's no prior judicial determination. It simply doesn't meet the elements of judicial estoppel.
So now, what is the remedy here then if we agree with you on the judicial estoppel? Does it go back for rehearing, or what is it you're requesting?
Yes, I'm asking that the court remand it and allow overrule that ruling on the motion and allow me to have an expert and present the case in a different manner and have an adversarial proceeding per se. That's what I'm asking.
Now, how did the judicial estoppel come before the court? Was that raised by the...
Yes, that was raised by Mr. Olson.
Were there other estoppel theories that were raised?
Not really. I think that in the appellee's brief, as I read it, he made some arguments about other theories of general estoppel, but the judicial estoppel was the primary focus, and that's the ruling of the court. If you look at that transcript that I just referred to,
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. That was the ruling. Now, I talked a little bit about the allocation, which I thought was not fair and equitable because of the differences in the earnings. But there was also a sort of a sub-issue to that, and that is that, and this goes to the heart of Justice Severson's question, this action that was before the court was limited to the funds that were in this trust. At least that's what the pleadings say, and that's what all the banter in the transcripts of the various proceedings, there were three proceedings, talk about the funds of the trust. Well, there was a $200,000 settlement with Cessna Aircraft that took place in the federal court that never was placed in the trust. And the funds were split 50-50 between my client and Mr. Olson's client. Mr. Olson argued successfully, the court adopted taking those funds and putting them back into the mix, so to speak, for allocation, after they had already been distributed. There's a stipulation that's in the record, and I don't have the court index here, but there's a stipulation that was presented to the court by a counsel dated December 18, 2008, in which they fully discuss the basis for that 50-50 split. And the trial court suggested that there wasn't any evidence to allow it to make that determination that it was, in fact, a 50-50 split, and I respectfully disagree. I think that stipulation covers it. And again, these funds were not part of that trust, which were what was before the court.
Did the pleadings in this matter include the $200,000 of that agreement?
I don't believe so, because they were not in the trust, and the pleadings were brought to disperse the monies in the trust.
The pleadings were limited to the trust residue.
Yes, that's my position.
Your time has expired, Mr. Finch. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Olson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, members of the court, and those in the audience, I'm not used to being on a stage with my back to the audience, and so I'm violating one of the prime requirements whenever you take the stage, is to always keep your eye on the audience. But in this case, we have audiences on both sides, so I will defer to the court in this matter. I'm pleased to be here this afternoon. I represent Stacy Sheasley, now Stacy Sheasley Wilcox, and the Sheasley estate. I've represented that estate since the time of Shane Sheasley's death. There was a question earlier about Mr. Banks' involvement. Mr. Banks was the counsel and is counsel for Action Mechanical. This is a terrible situation, and aircraft accident that occurred at Mission, South Dakota, a twin-engine aircraft that was owned by Action Mechanical, crashed after Tom Vermillion and Shane Sheasley had been down working on a large project down there, and the company pilot, Mr. Bilstein, was piloting the aircraft, and then during takeoff, an engine failed. The plane crashed. There were Mr. Banks was retained by the parties to bring this action. He had help from Jeffrey Hurd of the Bangs McCullen firm. In addition, they retained counsel out of Pennsylvania, who was an aircraft litigation expert. They commenced actions in state court to sue Capital City's air carrier, the seller of the airplane, and they commenced actions in federal court in Rapid City. During the trial, the state court action was settled for $2.5 million. The federal court action was later settled for $950,000. In addition, there was a settlement with Cessna for $200,000. During the course of the proceedings, the parties set up a trust account to put the money in until there could be a determination of how to allocate that money among the estates and among the beneficiaries of those estates. The trust fund was a holding vehicle. I don't think it was ever intended as anything other than that. In answer to your question, Justice Severson, I think that it was always a holding vehicle until the allocation could be made as to the various rights in the funds.
I guess where my question was going was that in reading the trust, I didn't see any of the normal type distribution clauses as to how distribution was to be made out of the trust. So where is the standard coming from to make the distribution? That's where my
There is no standard in the trust. You are correct.
So is the judge in that case applying trust law as to equitable distribution, or is it applying the wrongful death statute?
That's an interesting question, and I think that's the first time anybody's raised that question. And in this case, I think the parties have both approached it from applying the equitable distribution within an estate and have briefed it based upon those statutes and argued it based upon the same. And that is the way that it was brought about.
Maybe I don't understand that answer. I thought from the briefing it was pretty clear everybody agreed the wrongful death apportionment statutes.
I'm sorry, say again.
I thought it was pretty clear from the briefs that both sides were trying to apply the wrongful death apportionment statutes here.
Yes, I think that's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Not some equitable trust theory.
No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I misspoke on that. And the settlement were using those statutes.
And the settlement agreement didn't really talk about any of these issues that are raised between the parties when you settled it as to how it would be distributed.
No, there was nothing in the settlement about how it would be distributed among the parties.
Now, was there was a settlement agreement, and did a court approve that settlement agreement?
Yes, that settlement agreement was approved by the court in the state court proceeding and in the federal court proceeding.
And is that what the judicial estoppel is based on?
Yes. And our quite simply, the judicial estoppel in this case applies because the parties were all in court. They all took a position in court. They all used a common expert. And that expert helped them arrive at the economic loss, the total economic loss, that was recoverable. There were some interesting differences in the rulings in the two courts, but we take the law of the case in this one as it was determined in each. For example, in the state court, the court looked at Mr. Frankenfeld's opinion as to the additional value of the stock in the corporation. In the federal court disallowed testimony in an advance ruling on that issue. But in any event, those damages were established in both of those proceedings with one common expert. When we went to the trial of the allocation of this, then the Vermilion parties wanted to bring in another economic expert. There's only so much economic damage that can be determined, and we didn't have any defendants anymore to make the claims against. The parties made a decision to accept settlement in both of those cases based upon the evidence and testimony that was available in both of those cases.
Is that
they
written?
Relied on that.
Was that written anywhere?
Was
that
written?
That they
no,
were relying
that wasn't
on
written
that?
Anywhere.
So how did the trial court in this case with the declaratory judgment know that that was the agreement? Was there testimony?
It was stipulated.
It was stipulated.
It's all of the facts in this case are stipulated facts or are depositions and the transcripts from the proceedings.
Well, I'm having a hard time understanding it, how it's judicial estoppel if a judge has not actually made that determination in a prior proceeding.
Because all of the parties were in court together. They were all in a common proceeding, and they took an action that was approved by the court, a settlement, And that became a determination then of, that was a judicial determination at that point. They couldn't proceed further with that action. It was settled. They'd agreed to take this much money. What they didn't agree to was how to split that money. You can't come back with an expert later and say, well, Mr. Vermillion's economic damage is this much greater. He didn't present that to the court to get this pot of money. It's not equitable, and the parties may have made different decisions about settlement if they'd have had that evidence at that time. The settlement might have been different if they'd had that at that time.
But your scenario is requiring Vermillion to come in and challenge and do battle with his own joint attorney and to challenge Frankenfeld, the expert, on an issue that's not even before him, on an issue of allocation, which you indicate has not even been reached yet. So, I mean, that's an impossible scenario, isn't it?
No, I don't think that's not what I'm saying here. I'm saying that the parties agreed to that at that time.
Well, they never agreed to, they agreed to total damages. They never agreed to allocation.
But they both had all of that information at the time they made the agreement. And now if you change the fundamental facts, you're changing that. That's really not different from other cases of judicial estoppel where a stipulation has been involved.
I don't think I'm changing any fundamental facts. I think I'm relying on the stated facts that there was no agreement, no stipulation as to allocation, and now you're trying to bar the door on that issue.
Yes, and very for the reason of equity, Your Honor, because otherwise the parties might not have agreed to accept that settlement.
But wouldn't they be required to say so? Wouldn't they be required to say, well, yeah, I'll accept this settlement, but it's got to be on the basis that nobody can later come along and challenge apportionment or allocation?
No, and the parties had the right to allocate, to challenge allocation, but what I'm saying is they don't have the right to go out and get another economic expert for that purpose. The economic expert that they relied on to get the fund is the one that they have to stay with. And in the allocation trial, Mr. Finch argued his point about the various differences in Mr. Frankenfeld's testimony. The court made a decision based upon that. There was a chance for advocacy and determination of that in the allocation proceeding.
But yeah, maybe I'm missing something, but it appears to me that your suggestion would require Vermillion or Sheasley to come in and counter their own expert, to bicker with the expert, they would be destroying their presentation of damage, of total damages, by trying to say, wait a minute, you should have given more to Vermillion or Sheasley.
No, the issue for me is that you're changing the ball game after you've settled the case. You're saying, we're going to go out and get another expert here, and we don't have a defendant there anymore to get the damages from. So I'm going to take them away from the settlement pool that was determined based upon the facts that we had at the time. That's a settlement of an existing matter.
I got to stop you right there because twice you've said, you know, that based on the facts we had at that time, a core principle of estoppel is reliance, and you didn't have all the facts at that time. The non-economic damages were completely up in the air because Frankenfeld never testified or gave an opinion on non-economic damages.
He didn't testify on non-economic issues.
So the parties did not have at least that aspect of the damage settlement.
That's correct.
So how could there have been reliance, at least with respect to the non-economic damages?
There, I'm only talking about economic damages, and that was the request at the motion hearing to present an economic expert.
All right. My question to Mr. Finch was similar. Is how does the non-economic damages being introduced affect this? The settlement was based on economic damages, as I understand what Mr. Frankenfeld testified to at the trials, and now is there a different element being introduced on non-economic damages? Is that the core problem in this? Is that there's a different issue being introduced?
I think that's part of the problem. Yes, the non-economic damages there was no testimony in the trial as to the non-economic damages. And remained an issue between the parties.
Is that what the expert was noticed in the motion as his testimony? Was it as to economic damages, or was it to non-economic damages, or both?
It was as to economic damages. And that was the issue that was argued by this counsel.
But yet the trial court has to allocate both under the wrongful death statute.
That's correct. But the non-economic is a different factor. That goes to loss of advice, counsel, time spent with the people involved, and both of the parties briefed those issues and argued those issues to the court. And that was the trial court's determination as to how to allocate that, the non-economic pecuniary loss. And that's what, that's the issue that Judge Kern made decisions on.
Well, let me shift you back to the economics just for a minute, the economic damages. How is it that the trial court used the lowest possible salary the Sheasley estate and went the opposite way for the other estate? Or
Your Honor, what the trial court did was took what Mr. Frankenfeld said was his opinion. And he said his opinion was this. He had an alternative one, but when he testified, he said that was his opinion as to value. And that was the same thing that he did for both of the parties. He said this was his opinion of value, because he was asked, you could have used this higher value because Tom Vermillion had a tax return that was a higher value than he was currently earning at the time of his death. And he said, yes, but I thought the other one was more reliable. And in the case of Shane Sheasley, he said, yes, I could have used that lower amount, but I thought the other one was more reliable. It was his opinion. And the court examined all of this and made a decision based upon a review of all of that. There's substantial evidence that supports the court's decision. This is a very unfortunate set of circumstances that created all of this. It's been a difficult process for the parties involved. But judicial estoppel has been recognized by this court to apply in a stipulation situation in the Warren case. And the Corder case that's cited by the Vermillion estate is not applicable. And it's not applicable because in the Corder case, the parties stipulated that they could bring in additional testimony later on. And no one raised any estoppel claims in the trial court. The estoppel issue didn't come up until the appellate proceeding. So that case is clearly not applicable. The Warren case says that when you make stipulation, then you can't change your position later on to go against that stipulation. In this case, there was a reliance by the Wilcox estate, by the Sheasley estate, excuse me, based upon the testimony that had been admitted in the common economic expert. To allow additional economic expert testimony going forward when there's no additional there's no defendants left to make the claim against, then can cause harm to the party who relied upon the settlement.
But are they asking, I guess there's a difference between dividing the pie and increasing the size of the pie.
That's correct.
And they're just, as I understand it, they want to just divide the pie a little differently.
That's correct. I appreciate the court's time today and your diligent review of this matter. The decision that was made by Judge Kern was a well-reasoned decision. She made her findings and announced them in open court. The decisions follow the case law of the state of South Dakota. There was a substantial basis in fact for all of her findings, and that decision should be upheld by this court. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Finch, you have 10 minutes, sir.
A few brief points, and I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but Justice Everson's question, I think, is an important one, and that is to distinguish between the trust and the wrongful death. And clearly, both parties did proceed under the wrongful death allocation statute or apportionment statute, if you will. However, the question asked was about equitable distribution of a trust versus distribution under wrongful death apportionment. Well, the wrongful death apportionment statute has those two words, fair and equitable, as the requirement for that allocation. So, in essence, it's probably one and the same. The court approval of the settlement was as you all know, is a kind of a perfunctory thing. When there's a settlement and there's an estate involved, there has to be an approval by the court who has charge of the probate. That's a simple process. It really has nothing to do with the decision or the amount of the damages. It did not, by approval of that settlement, in any way, shape, or form, adjudicate the separate claims of these two estates. Now, our mission to seek a separate economist was not being done to try to enhance the damages that were already set. Obviously, they were set, and as Mr. Olson pointed out, there's no defendant there. Well, of course there's not, and the case is essentially finished, but the apportionment of those proceeds has to take place within an adversarial setting, in my view, and that's an important process. And by doing it the way it was done here, by the use of judicial estoppel, there was no adversarial process. Sure, I was able to make my arguments, but I didn't have any evidence other than what was already there by virtue of Frankenfeld's testimony in the underlying action. There's a difference, I think, between counsel making an argument on those points and actually having an economist give some testimony and have some evidence to support those theories. How much of the total of that settlement is economic and how much of it's non-economic? Nobody knows because it's a global settlement. And I hearken back again to the transcript of my motion hearing. There's an important point here, I think, that needs to be discussed in that vein, because what happened is, as pointed out actually by Mr. Olson, what happened in that underlying action is that they were mid-trial, and there was some evidence that came forth that appeared to be or give cause for an action for fraud. And the plaintiffs sought approval of the court to amend their complaint to institute a fraud count in the complaint. And at that point, the defendants came in and said, okay, we'll give you X amount of dollars and settle the case. So you can't even speculate as to what caused that amount of damage. It could have been that fraud part of it that was as much leading up to the what ultimately became the damage settlement as was Frankenfeld's testimony. So that's therein lies a concrete reason why judicial estoppel can't be applied in this situation. Now, yes, the Corder case is somewhat distinguishable on the facts, but as I pointed out earlier and I cited the Teledyne case in my reply brief, both Corder and Teledyne stand for the basic proposition that the apportionment proceeding is an adversarial process and it's a truth-seeking process. And you do not get at the truth in an adversarial process without having the parties be able to compete and have competing witnesses, and in particular expert witnesses as such in this case. Thank you.
I have one question. I mean, isn't it just a matter of fundamental fairness that to be able to say that these parties rely on Mr. Frankenfeld's numbers as to what one estate's economic damages were and what the other estates were? I mean, the parties had to have relied on the numbers he gave at that time.
Sure, they did, yeah.
And so why shouldn't that be binding?
They relied on those numbers in their underlying trial, but by the same token, he never testified on the non-economic damages. He specifically stated that.
Right, but just with respect to economics, I mean, those numbers, the ranges were set. Both families knew. One family knew they were in this range. The other family knew they were in this range. As far as what the evidence was. And they settled in reliance on that. Don't we have to assume that?
I don't think they had any idea that they were going to become adversaries at a later time in that sense. So I don't know that I understand what you're saying, but I don't think that they had common counsel. If they had separate counsel, they might have been advised that, you know, they should consider that there be a conflict later, but that sets up a whole new host of problems, and that's why I don't think judicial estoppel is appropriate in this case, because it has, I think, a tendency to have that chilling effect that I talked about earlier and perhaps demands that you have separate counsel on all these cases, which just in terms of judicial economy just isn't a good idea, I don't think.
Justice Savers, did you have a question?
Yes. Why shouldn't the $200,000 be thrown back into the pot to be determined according to the way you say this should be determined?
Well, I think there's at least two reasons, and one is that it was a totally separate settlement from the other monies that had already been deposited in the trust. The third plaintiff in this case, who was also in the trust at the beginning, was not part of that settlement. And there were reasons why he wasn't part of that settlement. But nonetheless, it was they sat down and agreed at the time of that settlement to divide those funds 50-50, and they were paid out. And each estate signed a release for receipt of 50% of those funds. And so I think that was, in essence, already allocated, so to speak, because there was no disagreement. If the parties had felt that they should put that in the trust or to have it allocated by the court, they could have set it aside in a separate trust because this third individual wasn't involved, or there would have been a number of different ways to handle it, but they didn't do that. They just sat down and said, we're going to split this up 50-50.
Judge Kern put it in the trust?
How did she put it in the trust?
No, why did she?
Well, that was at the request of Mr. Olson that it be brought back in to be reallocated. And she made the comment, as I recall, in court in the trial that she didn't see where there was any evidence to suggest that it was agreed to be a 50-50 split.
All right, Mr. Finch, were the funds actually brought in, or was it just considered as part of our equitable division? You said equity applied no matter which theory we use. So was that part of her consideration? Or
it No, they weren't, I guess, placed back in the trust, so to speak, but when she allocated the proceeds of the trust, she added those funds back in for the allocation. And after my client had already received 50% of that settlement and had paid her share of the attorney's fees on it, then all of a sudden she's down to 13% of it at the end of the day. And so I think that, moreover, as I pointed out, that December 18th, 2008 stipulation that was part of the record, I think clearly stated that the parties agreed that that was a 50-50 split outside the terms of the trust.
Is there some language, though, in Section 5 that suggests there was no agreement as to how the proceeds were to be allocated?
That's correct.
Isn't that dispositive? I mean, it wasn't a 50-50 agreement then, was it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm aging and I can't hear you.
Is it a 50-50 agreement, or does Section 5 say that there's no agreement as to allocation?
Section 5 of the release on the settlement, you mean? I'm sorry, I don't recall the actual language there, but the stipulation, I think, that was filed by the parties did spell out the fact that it was agreed to be a 50-50 split.
Still trying to quit? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll be in recess.